Bethany, I'd like to move over to you. You've been tracking contemporary CCP interference operations here in the United States more than any other American reporter that I'm aware of. Can you break out CCP influence operations activities here in the United States? Who are they, and what are they doing?
So Toshi has given a really great introduction to how the United Front works. Is this on? Can you hear me?
I don't know. Is it on? Maybe move it up a little bit. Oh, there, it's on. Mm-hmm.
Better? Okay. So what he said about wanting to co-opt, coerce, infiltrate organizations, and that very largely and often targets ethnic Chinese, that is something that is most definitely happening in the United States and has been happening for a long time. So I'm just going to go back in history a little bit to the early 90s. So after Tiananmen Square, the Chinese Communist Party realized that it had a problem. It had a global image problem. Many Chinese at that time left China to go abroad. And what the CCP did not want was a repeat of what had happened at the beginning of the 20th century, where there were these democracy movements that were flourishing outside of China. Obviously Sun Yat-sen did a lot of his, he was in Hawaii, he was in Japan. And so what the Communist Party did not want was a repeat of that, where there are very strong pro-democracy intellectual movements flourishing abroad that then can come back into China and change the regime. And so in the 90s, the United Front really made a big push, a big global push to get out of mainland China and to engage with, to try to guide overseas Chinese communities around the world. This most certainly happened inside the United States. And so you see in the 90s a gradual, I really dislike the word infiltrate, a gradual kind of influence over the overseas Chinese communities here. So for example, in the 90s, quite a number of Chinese people affiliated with state media outlets and with the United Front were basically sent to the United States to set up pro-Beijing Chinese language media outlets that were independent, but not really. So for example, there is one media outlet, and let me just say so I can't be sued, Taobao, the overseas Chinese press, is based in the U.S. and has no official financial ties to the Chinese Communist Party. Let me just say that. They were founded in 1992 by someone who previously worked for a Chinese state media outlet, came here, have been very, very pro-Beijing ever since. And so that is, that's an example of a type of supposedly independent outlet that, promotes Beijing's official views within the United States. There are a large number of those outlets. At the same time, you've seen a lot of pressure being placed on actually independent media outlets. So there's a scholar in California, John Pomfret, who's been doing a lot of research on this. And there are very, very few truly independent Chinese language media outlets left in the United States. The ones that are independent are affiliated with the Falun Gong mostly. And so how that kind of pressure works, if we're talking about media outlets, is Chinese businesses will be pressured in a way, and they will withdraw funding, advertising from local media outlets that have run articles that go against the party line. That's that's one way that it happens. Another way that it happens is media outlets in China, China Radio International or other state-run outlets will come to media outlets here and say, look, we'll give you free content. Isn't that great? We'll give you, we'll subsidize what you're doing. We'll give you free training. We'll give you free equipment. All you have to do is just, don't say anything that, really goes against what we want. And that, over time, the combination there of the carrot and the stick is very difficult to push back against, and is very effective. So that's the media outlets example is one example of how that kind of pressure has been very real in the United States. But let me talk directly about the United Front. So it operates in the United States very frequently through Chinese organizations, community organizations, businesses, professional associations. Some of these, were founded, Chinese people, when they come to the U.S., are like any other people. They form associations, they form community groups. This is normal and, a positive part of a real and active civil society. Through a similar kind of carrot and stick approach, since the 90s, many of these organizations have also been co-opted in a similar way as media outlets. So we'll give you funding, we'll give you business opportunities back in China, we'll come in and vote out your leadership and vote in people who are pro-Beijing, so that gradually over time, many professional associations, community organizations, Tongxianghui, which are the homeland organization, hometown organizations, like the Fujian hometown organization or something like that, or Zhejiang, whatever, so that these organizations that represent the Chinese community themselves are also going to be in alignment with Beijing. What the United Front also does is it has actually, or United Front linked officials, they actually will come in and form actual organizations of their own. And so a really great example of that are the Peaceful Reunification Societies. So there's something called the China Council for the Peaceful Reunification. It gets translated in different ways, but it's directly linked to the United Front Work Department. There's a main office in Beijing. They have branches in more than 70 countries around the world, and they have branches in more than 30 cities across the United States, including right here in Washington, D.C. And if you want to do what I have done, which is trace out United Front networks inside of the United States, a great place to start is to go to each one of these Peaceful Reunification Societies and look at their leadership. So who is the president, who's the vice chairman, look at that, and then look at their statements that they have made to supposedly independent Chinese language media outlets. And you'll see that they are meeting with United Front officials in China, they're meeting with United Front officials here in the United States. And so what you get from this whole complete picture of no longer having independent Chinese language media outlets, of many Chinese community associations, professional associations, student groups, including right here on the campus of George Washington University. What you get is a society within a society. So we have the United States. We supposedly have freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, but amongst the overseas Chinese community, it has become very difficult in the past 25 years to organize in as free a way as maybe other Americans can, because of this slow pressure from the United Front, from United Front officials. If you want to have views that support like an independent Taiwan, or if you don't like the Communist Party, you can have those views. But if you want to organize around that, if you want to publish Chinese language editorials about that, if you want to have, if you want to set up a national organization, to express your views, to have demonstrations, it becomes very difficult. You face a lot of pressure that comes from a lot of different areas of society, from businesses, from other organizations. And to that extent, this is a civil rights issue inside the United States that I think that our lawmakers, our media outlets, have done a poor job of protecting Chinese Americans and Chinese communities from the pressure and quite frankly the authoritarian policies that the Chinese Communist Party is trying to extend over here. It's also very difficult because when the United Front targets Chinese Americans, that in and of itself can foment racial divisions, in this country and suspicions. And in this particular moment in our politics, xenophobia and nativism is a real problem. And so even having a discussion like this about how, the CCP purposefully targets Chinese citizens abroad or even ethnic Chinese abroad who are, citizens of different countries, I think can create an aura of suspicion. And that is perhaps one goal of the Chinese Communist Party, because what does the party want? It wants to represent all Chinese. It wants to say, we are the only ones who can protect Chinese inside of China. We are the only ones who can protect Chinese outside of China. And if, you know, in the US, people, we've seen this some with Chinese scientists who have been at times, you know, wrongly targeted for espionage accusations. If there's a feeling here that, you know, Chinese are the target of racism, doesn't that prove the party's point that, you know, the party is the only one who can protect them?
Well, you know, Bethany, I mean, let me just hold you there. I mean, I think, but, you know, isn't it true that every government tries to influence, you know, another government? And so the difficulty seems to me about sorting between legitimate and malign types of activities that we talk about when, you know, influences. So can you sort of help us sort this out a little bit? How do you distinguish between what is, you know, benign or legitimate activities versus what is malign activities?
Right. I mean, there's a lot of different countries in the world, and countries do different things. And if you look at the United States, we have a whole range of things that we have done, including, you know, overthrowing a democratically elected prime minister in Iran. That was not great. That would be a kind of malign influence. We also, you know, have really great organizations like the National Endowment for Democracy that, you know, give funds to people abroad to try to bring them over to our ideology, which is democracy. So what's the difference between that and what we see as, you know, what the United Front is doing here? Well, part of what happens here, you know, inside the US and elsewhere is that there is a suppression and a coercion that is often covert. So in Australia, some terminology that has now been adopted by the government there is, you know, to talk about CCP influence is that it is coercive, corrupt, and covert. A lot of times, if you're trying to suss out how it works, like, so one thing that United Front officials do in the US is they will identify donors. So they'll go through donor lists for, you know, elected officials, and they'll say, look at these people who are donating a lot. Let's target them, so that the next time they give a donation, you know, they can, you know, say, well, you know, we think you should support Beijing's claims in the South China Sea or whatever. And that is the kind of thing that the U.S. tends to do and not be proud of. You know, like, that's maybe what some of our agencies do abroad. That's classified. So it's not like we don't do it. But there's an element of coercion, of suppressing speech, of preventing people from expressing themselves freely. And that is certainly malign. Mm-hmm. Let me give a quick example of how it can differ legally, because we're talking about things that maybe are about ideology and morality, but not so much about laws. So in the United States, if a person informs on someone in the dissident community, so let's say someone is collecting information about Uyghurs here in the US for China, just personal information, and they pass that along. That is not illegal. That is completely legal. It's not good. I don't think it's moral, but it's not illegal. So there's no way to prosecute that person who's doing that. That's not true in Sweden. You know, last month or 2 months ago, a person was arrested in Sweden for doing that exact thing on the Tibetan community. So in Sweden, that behavior is most certainly illegal. But it's not in the U.S., so our laws are different. So it depends a little bit on how you define it.
Well, Bethany, that's a great segue to my next question. I'm sticking with you here right now, is that the U.S. Congress is simply, it's not sitting on its hand, right? I mean, can you go over what you see Congress is doing to address these issues that, you know, you've highlighted?
Well, there's been a lot of positive movement forward in the past 6 months, and a lot of that is due to Marco Rubio. I don't, you know, people have different opinions about his politics in general, and I certainly don't agree with everything that he says or does. But on the issue of CCP influence and the United Front, he's really quite good. And he's not the only one, but there's been growing interest in both the House and the Senate around this issue, and that's good. So there's a couple of things that I will point out that are definitely steps in the right direction. And these both involve transparency. And a lot of United Front activity dies in the sunlight. And that's an important point to make, because to the extent that we're talking about narrative and about, you know, China winning the war for its image and winning the war over its narrative in a liberal democracy, a lot of that cannot be legislated, because that's the whole point. So there, a few months ago, there was, or last two months ago, there was a resolution that was introduced, saying that, and it was, it had bipartisan support. So there was a whole group of Democrats and Republicans who supported it, saying that the U.S. government should come up with an interagency, non-classified report on United Front activity in the United States. Now that's important because the government, the U.S. government, has been tracking the United Front for a long time, and it has not released any information about what it knows, and that's really frustrating. You know, unlike Australia, where intelligence officials have been, the government has been more forthcoming. So that would bring a lot of this out into the sunlight, where we can have a debate. You know, about, for example, when Chinese groups are paid by the embassy to come and, you know, show their support for Xi Jinping when he visits D.C. And in doing so, they actively try to prevent, you know, Falun Gong practitioners and other dissidents from expressing their views. You know, they want to just occupy the space. I mean, that's something that actually happens. They say, occupy the space so that these people, you know, can't express their opinions to Xi Jinping. And that kind of thing changes our debate because we look at that and we think, oh, wow, look at all these people who really just love the Chinese Communist Party. But if there's transparency about that, it kind of kills it. It kills the covert nature of that way to change the debate. So to have, you know, a report about it, a public report, would be great. There was also a letter that was, again, it was signed by a bipartisan group of 12 senators. It was written to Pompeo and Mattis and Christopher Wray, head of the FBI. You know, saying, you know, would you please let us know? We think you should have a strategy to counter this, you know, to counter Chinese pushback against Western and liberal democracy. And, you know, let us know if you have a strategy. We deserve to know what that is. And if you don't, can you please formulate one? So these are very good and positive steps forward. And I'm glad to say that so far, the more extreme versions of what this could be, you know, because what we do not want is a sense of, we don't want the U.S. government to end up with a relationship with the Chinese community similar to the relationship it has with the American Muslim community. We don't want them to feel like they're being targeted in that way. And so far, it is going well.
Right. And you made a very interesting observation when you said occupy the space, and how, you know, the Chinese CCP United Front is trying to, you know, basically occupy the space to prevent you know, the free speech by other groups that it disagrees with. And I think this goes to my question for you, Shanti, because one of a critical space in this era now is the information space, right, and cyberspace. And the information and communication technology revolution, and in particular internet, have expanded our ability to interact with one another and also our governments in multiple ways. The inverse is true. It allows our governments to interact more with us. You know, generally in the West, I think the debate about cyberspace, information space is framed in terms of civil liberties and the balance between civil liberties and security. But I feel like the CCP has a very different view about the global information space and the system. And you've written a great report about this for NED, and I perhaps you could tell us a little more how you see the CCP view the global information system.
Sure. You know, to begin with, take you back a few years when people were still trying to understand how the Chinese government was attempting to shape political expression just within its own borders. This was when the Great Firewall was being developed. And I think there was a perception at that time, particularly before the internet really spread throughout China, that the dominant approach, at least internally, was to just clamp down and to squash that space and to have it be a very sanitized place that contained no attractions for people, really, so that people within China that wanted any kind of information would feel like they had to jump out and go access some sources outside. I think if you look at that space now, even with the tightening of that space in recent years, and particularly under Xi Jinping, it's really quite a vibrant space. I mean, you can go to China and wave your cell phone at something and pay for any number of things and take care of your life in ways that will seem to us, living in the U.S., like some kind of technological miracle, because it links together seamlessly so many different aspects of your life. And in some ways, that can be quite appealing. Moreover, you will find lots of information that you might find interesting. You'll find entertainment news. You can follow the celebrities and the singers and all the pop stars that you want. You can engage in certain types of debate and discussion and have a very rich kind of internet experience. The metaphor that I think best captures this, as opposed to the Great Firewall, is something more of a walled garden. If you think of the CCP as the gardener trying to encourage certain blooms to take root and to have some kind of flowering variety of different colors, and yet to ruthlessly weed out anything that might be displeasing, that to me is a metaphor that makes a little bit more sense for the development of the information space within China. Critically, that approach is now being brought to bear outside of China's borders. And this is something that I think marks a real change, particularly in just the last few years. I think if you had made that case prior to the last few years, people would say, you know, I really don't buy that. But what's changed is that, in particular, the Chinese internet firms that were nourished and nurtured behind the walls of that garden, which were allowed to grow big and which benefited from certainly the direction of the state, they're now big enough to take that approach globally. And increasingly, some of these firms are engaging with the outside world. As you know, there's a lot of ties between the Chinese tech sector and the outside world. And in addition to that, I think the approach taken by the Chinese government has remained consistent. And that approach, I would say, generally breaks down into three main elements. First, it's the technology. So in the original conception of the Great Firewall, the censorship system for the Chinese internet, there was a lot of reliance on the infrastructure, on censoring materials, not simply at one level, but making that redundant throughout many layers of the system so that you could shut off whole pipes, or you could be very granular going into sort of, you know, at the time people would talk about deep packet sniffing, pulling out specific pieces of information to get ever more granular in the way that censorship is enabled. So technology. The second aspect is that it's not about just technology. It actually really relies on a complex interplay between technology and the promotion of self-censorship, which is inherent in the Chinese system. So you really can't have this type of information approach without some agreed understanding that you're going to censor yourself and you are going to manage yourself in this space, or essentially bad things will happen to you. The third is that all of this is predicated on that relationship between both private citizens in the state as well as firms, corporations in the state, which is, I think people have mentioned this carrot and stick approach, but essentially that if you play by our rules, then you will benefit. And if you contravene those rules, you will suffer some kind of sanction. Now, the Chinese technology firms have certainly done very well within that broad framework of knowing where those lines are and being able to innovate, in some cases, quite tremendously in some places, and yet knowing how to do so in a way that will not get them crosswise with the interests of the party. Mm-hmm. So again, this multi-layered approach is being brought to bear outside of China now. So that, again, it's about the technology. It's not just about the technology. It's also predicated on these mutually shared understandings, which I think Bethany and Toshi have talked about a little bit, sort of the idea that, you know, you self-censor yourself because you understand that there are certain lines that you don't cross. And again, you don't do that unless there is this kind of relationship which can provide both benefits in some cases, but also can be extremely coercive in other cases. Mm-hmm. And that, I think explains that broad approach to the global information space right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as both Toshi and Bethany alluded to, United Front work involves mobilization, indoctrination control of a lot of non-CCP masses. How is and can the CCP utilize the tools of the information age to wage political warfare or influence operations, in your perspective?
So, you know, the things that I typically look at, I would say, probably don't fall within the rubric of political warfare, perhaps, but certainly you can see that they would represent some form of CCP influence that would serve to restrict certain either liberties or freedoms. So, for instance, if you look at the CCP's involvement in the media space outside of its borders. I think Bethany has already done a good job of outlining how that happens, particularly with respect to Chinese language media. But you know, it's not only in the case of Chinese language media. So for instance, if you look at what's happening on the African continent in certain countries, the Chinese government has poured tremendous resources into shaping the information space and the media space of those countries. And so that's done both through official state-owned organs like CGTN, used to be CCTV, now CGTN, where that can be quite a prominent feature of the television and the digital landscape, or through other ways, say through cable providers. So, you know, in Nigeria and other countries, Star Times, which is a big Beijing cable provider, is going in there and offering really sweet deals and offering perks like, say, World Cup coverage or other things to draw people to those packages. But there are certain aspects of that system that I think the populations of those countries are not fully cognizant of. And I think this is part of the issue, is that as these companies and as the CCP tries to expand this influence over the global information space, in some of the bigger liberal democracies, there are the resources to try to cover these things and to fully explicate this issue. Bethany herself has reported on a lot of these things in the US, but that's, I would say, actually quite an unusual case. I think in many of these situations, particularly in vulnerable democracies in developing countries, there's simply not the resources to understand what's happening. And so a lot of these things end up getting rolled out, whether it's technological cooperation, whether it's the participation of either state companies or state-linked companies in providing critical infrastructure, in providing the infrastructure for smart cities. A lot of these things are happening in real time that are just going completely under-scrutinized, I would say.
Well, in your report, Beyond a Great Firewall, How China Became a Global Information Power, for anyone who hasn't read it yet, I highly recommend it. It's on NAD's website. You warned about the dawning of an authoritarian information age. Tell us more about what you saw and what you see and why you wrote that.
So in that report, I looked at a few different areas. One was sort of this media space, which I just touched on. And sort of those ideas related to the governance of the internet, sort of the idea that the internet would become balkanized according to China's own vision of enabling individual countries to set the rules for the internet within their own borders, and thus essentially sabotage the idea of the global internet as a free and open internet that could be a resource for everybody. So that's one area. The other was sort of looking at, well, the technology, the media space, and the third was looking at cultural production. And that's, to me, if you're looking at a specific example where it was really striking for me to delve into, because I'm a bit of a movie buff, I would go to movies and kind of wonder why I was only seeing positive depictions of China or the Chinese science program. It piqued my interest enough to sort of have a section of this report devoted to it. And the truth is that because of these extensive tie-ups between Hollywood companies and Chinese film production companies, and because the Chinese market is so important now to Hollywood and indeed all film industries all over the world, because it's such a vast potential market, there's so much incentive for films, cultural products, to be shaped at the source in ways that don't offend China, or the Chinese government, I should say. Mm-hmm. And that is, while you may not say that's an authoritarian environment, it's certainly not one in which you see the full diversity of views. And it's one which is being proactively shaped to suit the preferences of an authoritarian government. And in this, you know, maybe I would frame it a little bit differently as I've been thinking about it, because, you know, when I originally wrote that report, I originally envisioned this as a problem that would be, you know, similar to the way that Toshi put it. You had this group of like-minded countries, all either authoritarian, leaning authoritarian, or a liberal, that would use China as a model, and China would seek to maybe export some of those techniques. But increasingly, even in the time that since when I put together that report in late 2016 till now, I think where you see the most interesting examples and perhaps the most troubling examples of these things happening is within democracies that have very different value systems. And I think, to me, the danger is not so much that these democracies will suddenly become authoritarian or liberal and hew to Chinese values, but that they will simply accept the slow erosion of their own democratic values because they prioritize their relationship with China. And to me, I think China would be happy with that. I don't know that the Chinese government would necessarily want or need the whole world to become authoritarian, but, and Toshi, I know you quoted Aaron Freeberg here, to make the world safe for authoritarianism, essentially democracies have to give up that essential piece of their own character, which unfortunately I think that we have seen happening in a number of countries around the world. So maybe that's parsing it out a little bit more, but either way it redounds to the benefit of the CCP.
That's great, thank you. And